We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm happy to be joined once again by Aaron Sabarium. He's a reporter at the Free Beacon. He's also the co-host of the podcast Institutionalized. Aaron, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Emily.
One thing we haven't covered extensively, just because there's so much new information coming out to this day all of the time, is the horrible mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas. We covered it a bit as breaking news. But now that we have a little bit more time in the rearview mirror, there are some takeaways that are becoming clearer and clearer. And Aaron did some really important reporting for the Free Beacon. And I think one of those takeaways, he has an article out that's called "The Legal Precedent that haunt Uvalde." There have been many changes to policing, some of which we've covered here over the course of recent years. And I think it's well worth talking about some of those issues that Aaron raises. Now, Aaron, you started the story. This is what I mean by developing news every single day, still coming out of Robb Elementary. You start the story with an anecdote that shortly after came into question. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there and, you know, basically what the new reporting is about that anecdote?
So there was a report a couple weeks ago that claimed, based on, I think, an interview or two with some of the police officers who was there, that one cop had a shot at the shooter before he entered the elementary school, hesitated, turned to his supervisor, asked, "Can I take the shot?" By the time he turns back around, the guy's already inside the school. It's too late. Now, that was a very dramatic opening to my story, which was a totally defensible thing to print, given that that anecdote had basically been reported in CNN and all sorts of other media outlets. It now appears that that is not what happened, and that the person who they thought was the shooter was actually a gym coach. Although that follow-up report is itself also based on police testimony, and, you know,
right,
it's like hard to know. I mean, I think it's probably now the case, like the best reading of the evidence is probably they didn't have a shot at the suspect. But all of this, it's worth bearing in mind, is coming from police officers who have been taking a ton of heat for how they handled Uvalde. So I think, you know, everyone should put a little asterisk by kind of any developments in the narrative, because, you know, as the left often says, police have an incentive to lie. And in fact, this is one of the cases where they would have an incentive to lie. I doubt they're lying, because a number of them have kind of corroborated each other. And, you know, it was a Texas House investigation. There's all sorts of reasons to think, yeah, they're probably telling the truth and this is just a complicated situation. But bottom line, you know, probably they didn't have a shot at the suspect. At one point, it looked like they did. It's still not entirely clear what happened.
Yes. And, you know, that's well worth keeping in mind. It does seem that every little bit more we learn, the worse the entire situation looks. It never seems to get better. But to the point of this article, again, the headline is "The Legal Precedents That Haunt Uvalde," and the subheading is "Cops Have Pulled the Trigger on Active Shooters and Paid the Price." There has been some conversation about, I mean, let's talk about incentives that officers have and incentives they don't have. What do you mean, Aaron, if you could walk us a little bit through the history of that subhead where you say cops have pulled the trigger on active shooters and paid the price? What examples do we have to look back on that could have been informing this situation?
Well, there have been at least three cases in Texas where the Fifth Circuit Appeals Court has either sent officers to trial or at least sent the county of which the officers were a part to trial, because police have pulled the trigger in sort of split second active shooter cases. What's basically happened in all those cases, I'm simplifying, is that there was an armed or at least apparently armed suspect. There was a credible threat of imminent violence. In some cases, the police were responding to situations in which shots had already been fired. In one situation, there was literally a guy who appeared to be on his way to a Texas high school who had announced that he had planned to shoot up his girlfriend and kill himself. And I mean, he just, it was like a stereotypical, you know, that this, the exact profile of someone who would go and shoot up a school. And basically in all these cases, you know, cops catch up to the guy and, or who they think is the guy, and they have really like only a few seconds to decide, do I pull the trigger? Because if they don't, they might themselves get shot. The guy might, you know, leave their sight, whatever. And they make the split second decision, to pull the trigger. And then they end up in legal trouble, or at least someone ends up in legal trouble as a result of this.
Well, and this is amazing because this case that you're zooming in on, well, so in the piece you zoom in on Windsor v. Kaufman County, this case is in Texas. It's from 2019. The decision came down in 2019, and you have this quote from Fifth Circuit Judge James Ho, who says, if we want to stop mass shootings, we should stop punishing police officers who put their lives on the line to prevent them. I mean, it's almost like prescient.
Yes, it's extremely prescient. And, you know, it, now, look, to be very fair, right, if it is the case that the cop actually had a shot, not at the suspect, but at a gym coach, you know, if you empower cops to make these sorts of split second calls, sometimes they are going to shoot the wrong person, right? Yep. And, right, you know, empowering the police to use force in these scenarios effectively is accepted. I mean, the price of that is going to be, put bluntly, the police will shoot some innocent people. Statistically, just that's eventually going to happen, right? You know, if police shoot in these kinds of cases. But the problem, right, is that if you reliably send them to trial anytime they shoot in these cases, you know, even if in good faith they it was reasonable for them to think the guy was the suspect, even if it was reasonable for them, you know, to think, in some cases very correctly think, that if I don't pull the trigger, you know, bad things are going to happen, right? If you penalize them in those sorts of cases, you're going to get a problem in the other direction where cops no longer pull the trigger, potentially. And if they don't pull the trigger, then a psychopath might go and shoot up lots of kids. And I mean, you know, another thing just to be blunt is that, you know, the cost of an officer pulling the trigger in this sort of case is usually that one person dies. The cost of them not pulling the trigger, it could be that the guy was totally innocent and nobody dies, and that would be great. It could also be that the guy really was a bad guy, and by not pulling the trigger, they sentence, like, you know, however many children to death, right? So, you know, this isn't to take a position on exactly what the cop should do in any one case, but if you want law enforcement to, you know, not pull back and to at least feel comfortable, you know, pulling the trigger in these sorts of scenarios, it probably doesn't make sense to send them to trial when they really had, you know, only like 2 seconds to kind of figure out, is this guy a bad guy or not, right?
Right. And again, there's, I mean, every new scrap of video that we get out of Uvalde is more upsetting because it shows, they seem to reveal constantly how poor the police response is. But the more we've seen from those body cam videos, there's the body cam video that came out, I think it was just this week, of one of the first officers who rushed the classroom. He got brushed in his ear, and you can see him, you can see his fingers sort of taking the blood from the head, and you see all of that happening. But it's, a lot of people have looked at that video and just been confounded by the reality that the cops are not rushing and beating down the door. In fact, what they did was they got brushed by a bullet and retreated. And it seems so counterintuitive to, you know, the way that we've always expected law enforcement to act in this country. But I'm also curious, because one thing you folded into your report, I'm just reading from it here. You say, as Black Lives Matter has drawn attention to cases of police misconduct, a growing chorus of liberals and libertarians has argued the trade-off isn't worth it. The New York Times in 2021 called for an end to what it termed the, quote, doctrine that enables police brutality, while 2020 report from the Cato Institute dubbed qualified immunity, quote, a moral failure. Faced with demands to defund the police, moderate Democrats have framed qualified immunity as a more productive punching bag, proposing legislation to curtail or eliminate it. So in various localities, some of this is on the books, some of it isn't, but that sort of idea that as a police officer, you're under the microscope in ways that can be you know, I like body cams. I think none of this is to say that police are all good apples, and that, you know, we should just reflexively trust every single thing they do. But at the same time, there does seem to be something about the mentality or the ideology that's been very much mainstreamed and legitimized by the kind of cultural gatekeepers that has to make police officers hesitant in some ways that's hard for civilians to understand.
Yeah, and I'd say there's a couple different things going on here. So one is the question of what they're thinking in any particular moment, right? And what some people pointed out, and indeed I even said in my piece, is that it's not really clear that, you know, in those split 3 seconds before you have to shoot a suspect, that cops are thinking about appellate court precedents. And like, right. Like, no, probably not. But what can happen, I think, is that if officers see their colleagues get hauled up to, hauled in front of court for either making a reasonable but mistaken judgment, or in some cases even for making what very well may have been the correct decision under the circumstances, right? They are going to, there's going to be a morale problem, and they're going to think, oh, sorry, I shouldn't say that.
we'll bleep you out, Aaron.
I mean, you know, crap. If this happens to me, you know, if I'm in this situation, I do the same thing, I might have my career destroyed. That's just not worth it. So then the officer, maybe they won't, you know, maybe they'll be just more cautious in the field, or maybe they'll just leave the force. And this is really the other big thing that's happening is there's been this unprecedented exodus from the police, as people, I think, quite rationally recognize that this is a profession that is no longer held in very high esteem by our elite classes, and that there are all sorts of vested interests in making sure that officers pay the price anytime they do anything that essentially falls short of perfection, or that's just unpopular, even if in context it was actually good, right? Like, there's a recent case now where people are mad that the cops shot a guy who was firing indiscriminately into a woman's apartment where she and her two children were present. I mean, and the cops shot him, you know, I'm sorry, but that seems like a totally reasonable thing for the police to do. And, you know, still you have protests saying, how dare they kill this, you know, poor mentally ill black man. And it's like, yeah, it's sad that they killed a black man. Not that his race really should matter, but it's sad that they killed a guy who clearly had mental health problems, but he was trying to kill a woman and her two children, you know?
Well, so, it's like the case in Minneapolis. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think the steel man, right, worry about, you know, exposing police to more liability isn't necessarily that they're going to think about it in the moment, but that it's going to create examples out of people that will then exacerbate this morale crisis and lead to staffing shortages. And if there's staffing shortages, it means that it takes longer to respond to 911 calls. And if it takes longer to respond to 911 calls, it's going to take longer to stop active shooters. You know, it's kind of unavoidable.
Something we talk about a lot on this podcast is how recent changes to the way humans live their everyday lives have caused all of these other downstream changes that are pretty major and that we don't actually think about that often. For instance, did you know that poor sleep can cause weight gain, mood issues, poor mental health, and lower productivity? Think about this. Sleeping less than 6 to 7 hours per night is actually linked to reduced white blood cell count. And those white blood cells protect our body against illnesses and diseases. They fight viruses, they fight bacteria, and so much more. I am one of those people that absolutely needs critical sleep. I need absolutely more sleep than most people probably do, but it's a huge difference, and we all know that because we all need it. Introducing Beam Dream. Beam is the world's most innovative functional wellness brand with unique products for everything from sleep to recovery. And today, our listeners get a special discount available for Beam's sleep product, Dream Powder, their best-selling healthy hot cocoa. It contains natural, sleep-promoting premium ingredients, triple lab-tested, no THC, and you wake up feeling refreshed, which in my opinion is just about the best feeling in the world. 98% of people surveyed fall asleep faster when taking Beam Dream, and 99% of people experience better sleep quality. You just mix Beam Dream into hot water or milk, you stir it, and you enjoy it before bedtime. Just taking the stuff out of the box, I took a look at it and said, this is awesome. You can find out why Forbes and New York Times are all talking about Beam and why it's trusted by the world's top business professionals and top athletes. Don't love it? You can get your money back guaranteed. For a limited time, get up to 35% off when you go to shopbeam.com/Federalist and use code Federalist at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/Federalist and use code Federalist for up to 35% off.
The other point I would just make parenthetically is that a lot of people have been dunking on my piece because it referenced this anecdote that now appears to not be true. I mean, we couldn't have known that at the time, but okay, fine. You know, 4 days later, it turns out not to be true.
Well, we think it's not true. And like you said, I mean, it's still kind of up in the air. I mean, I assume.
Yes, it is. It is up in the air, given that the police, who knows what they're thinking and whether we should trust them. But I just assume that anecdote didn't happen, that they really didn't have a shot at the guy. But then, so all we know is that they were just waiting around in school. Well, I would just note that, you know, if they were waiting around for an hour, right, most of the research saying cops don't think about court cases before they, you know, like shoot a suspect comes from split second decisions. But if the whole point, if these critics of mine are saying, well, but it wasn't a split second decision, they were, you know, that didn't happen. Okay. But if they were in the school for an hour and then they got shot at and then they retreated, they probably actually did have time to think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is not unreasonable to imagine that in that hour, not a split second, one thing that was on their minds was, let's say we go into the room and try to breach it, right, and kill him, but our bullets hit a kid who's still alive and we end up killing a kid, right? Which was totally a possibility. And, you know, it's very, very unlikely that in that case where it's just so overwhelmingly clear cut that, you know, the cop would be denied qualified immunity. I'd be surprised if that happened, even, you know, if the court were more anti-cop. But you know, the point is psychologically, the more instances you have of police being vilified, right, the more you're going to worry. What if, like, when I fire through the wall at the suspect, I actually hit the kid, you know? And so I, as you say, I think that, you know, even if that opening anecdote is totally wrong, the broader context of what happened and the broader context of what's been happening suggests that there is at least some concern, some reason to hesitate before totally tossing out any kind of police immunity. And I should just add that, you know, qualified immunity is a very particular legal doctrine. Mm-hmm. There have been lots of proposals to reform it that don't totally get rid of it. And then there's other proposals that involve getting rid of qualified immunity as it exists today, but still finding other legal tools to protect cops from frivolous lawsuits. So, you know, in theory, you could be very anti-qualified immunity, but still think it's ridiculous that these cops, you know, who maybe split-second calls got sent to trial. And that's,
yes.
Like, but in fact, if you read some of Judge Ho, the dissent you cited, Judge Ho, he has elsewhere actually said that he's very skeptical of qualified immunity. So people conflate being, you know, people conflate qualified immunity with this sort of just like, oh, you think cops should be able to shoot, you know, whenever. No, I mean, qualified immunity is a very particular thing. Some people oppose it who nonetheless think it's important for there to be protections for cops acting in these scenarios. But I think it's telling that the loudest anti-qualified immunity voices don't tend to talk very much about what they would do to make sure cops don't get hit with frivolous lawsuits. They seem to think that a lot more cops should be being sued than currently are. including some of the cops who did make these split second judgment calls. And I would just say, you know, I don't agree with that. I think that in these sorts of split second cases, even if the cop makes what's ultimately the wrong call, we should construe reasonability in a pretty wide way and just recognize that, you know, it's not always possible for police to avoid shooting in these kinds of cases. And sometimes, yeah, the wrong person's going to get hit. But the alternative is that you allow armed maniacs to go on rampages, which will probably kill more people.
Yeah. Yeah. No, of course. And I've gotten I've gotten dogpiled before for using phrases like cost benefit analysis when you're talking about like really tragic things, human lives. Right. But morally, that is what you're doing. You're saying the cost of X is worth the benefit of saving Y. And that's, you know, we might as well just be honest about the logic that's at play, because that's a moral calculation. That is a moral logic. And I wanted to ask you, Aaron, because I want to get into some of your what you discussed about the Fifth Circuit, just because there's some interesting, I think, stuff going. There's some interesting stuff that gets to the conservative movement more broadly when we talk about the Fifth Circuit. But since that conversation is sort of focused on qualified immunity, could you just do a brief description or give a brief description of what qualified immunity is for listeners?
Yeah, qualified immunity is basically a doctrine that shields government officials from civil lawsuits. Note, it doesn't just shield them from liability, it shields them from even being sued in the first place, which is an important distinction. And the whole rationale for this is that lawsuits themselves have costs, because you have to go through trial and, you know, deal with it. And even if you know that you're going to win, it's just time consuming, and it's something that it can hurt your reputation, etc. So the rationale for this is, if you make it hard to sue government officials for sort of discharging their duties reasonably, even when they make a mistake, you'll create more latitude for them to do their jobs. And if you can sue them for every little thing, including even little things they do wrong, but do wrong kind of, you know, in do wrong, but not in a sort of unreasonable, crazy way. You know, if you sue them for things like that, you're just going to create all these nightmares where like no one wants to do the job, and it's just impossible for government to work. And it's controversial really as applied to police, because police are agents of the state, so qualified immunity applies to them. And the reason it makes it very hard to sue cops is that it doesn't just ask, was the cop reasonable? It asks whether they violated clearly established law. And what that means in practice is, in order to sue the cop, you have to find a case with a very similar fact pattern where the court ruled for the plaintiff. So to take it, let's be concrete. There was a case where a guy was already surrendering on the ground, and the police sicked a dog on him, and he tried to sue the cop. And the judge said, well, there's been a case where the guy was lying down on the ground and had a dog sicked on him, where they said that, yeah, that was clearly, you know, violating the Fourth Amendment. So, you know, you know, you can sue him. But in this case, he wasn't on the ground. He had his hands up. And because they were he was in a different position, you know, it's not actually clear that there's any precedent for, you know, saying that he violated the law, the cop violated the law by sicking the dog on him. So you're out of luck. You can't sue him for sicking the dog on you. He already surrendered. I think most people, now I'm obviously all these cases, there's more details, you know, but that was like one example that people at places like Cato, for example, will point to. Come on, guys, this is just ridiculous. And yeah, you know, it creates a real barrier to suing cops, because even if you show that they weren't reasonable, there's still this kind of added test that you have to pass. And that's just really hard to do. So there are actually proposals to basically just remove that test, but still say that you look at like, well, was the cop acting in good faith or something like that? And that's the idea behind that, right? Is you would, you'd still have the protection, right? If the cop made this split second judgment to shoot a guy who had a gun, you know, most people would say, okay, that was reasonable, or that was good faith. So, you know, they're off the hook. But in other kinds of cases, you know, it would make it probably easier to sue the cops. So, you know, and so I would just say, right, qualified immunity is kind of in a very extreme form of protection. There's a lot of less extreme forms that would still probably get the job done. I think the issue is that at this point, the debate has sort of polarized between, like, you know, totally abolish police immunity, sue them for every little thing because they're all racist pigs. And then, you know, there are people on the other side who just seem to believe that cops can do no wrong and should just be shielded from anything. And obviously that's not true, as in some ways Uvalde showed, right? Cops are not perfect people. They f*** up, and sometimes the f*** ups are pretty serious and not really particularly reasonable.
Right, right. No, no, no. And that's a good point. And I think it's especially Uvalde is a really good reminder of it. And I think you can look back to Parkland as well, which was sort of a shocking case of police inaction, no matter how you spun it. If you're like me, you might be dreading looking at your 401k or IRA account balance lately. You're not alone, and we're hearing all of the experts say there's just no place to hide. But that's simply not true. The truth is you can build a financial bunker that grows and protects your money even during the scariest economic times. The Bank on Yourself Retirement Plan alternative lets you escape the financial carnage and has never had a losing year in over 160 years. Whether you've been investing for years or you're just starting out, now is the time to bypass Wall Street and bank on yourself. Bank on Yourself lets you reach your financial goals and dreams without taking any unnecessary risks. You get guaranteed predictable growth and retirement income with no luck, skill, or guesswork needed. The strategy also lets you take a tax-free retirement income, which protects you from the coming tax tsunami. Unlike a government-controlled 401k, IRA, or similar plan, you control the money in your plan, not the government. You can use the money for any purpose with no questions asked without interrupting the growth of your savings. This is the strategy famous businesses like McDonald's have used when no banker would lend them a dime, and almost anyone can do it. Plus, there's no volatility. Your plan doesn't go backward when the markets tumble. Both your principal and growth are protected. You can get a free report with all the details of how adding Bank on Yourself to your financial plan can help you take back control of your money. Just go to bankonyourself.com/Federalist. That's bankonyourself.com/Federalist. Your discussion of the Fifth Circuit Court in this piece is really interesting. You write, though some commentators have painted it as aggressively pro-cop, the court has been fairly stingy about granting qualified immunity, even after the Supreme Court rebuked it in 2015 for second-guessing the police. You go on to talk about how, because you have a pretty long discussion here about the Fifth Circuit. You go, why has the Fifth Circuit, a court stacked with far-right Trump goons, quote, as the progressive law professor Lisa Needham put it, been less gung-ho about qualified immunity? Part of the answer may lie in its increasingly libertarian composition. One Trump-appointed judge, Don Willett, is a hero of the libertarian legal movement and an outspoken critic of qualified immunity, which he has blamed for untold constitutional violations. And the sort of zooming in on the Fifth Circuit, which has made decisions in Texas-specific cases. I'm curious because you just mentioned, you know, the arguments, the counterpoints that Cato may raise. I'm curious as to, in recent years, how this question of qualified immunity or even just police accountability in general has played out between the Don Willetts of the world and the Back the Blue sort of, the red meat kind of part of the space, where obviously there's room for nuance between both of those positions. And that seems to be a tug of war that's happening in the conservative legal movement, at least over the last 5 or so years.
Yeah, I think there are a few things going on here. So obviously, you know, and if you just zoom out and look at the country, I would say the more right-wing you are, the more on average you're going to be pro-cop. You know, normal Americans, like, you know, who are not sort of conservative elites, right? I would say, like, you know, probably your average Trump voter likes the police a lot. maybe not the police, all of them at the Capitol on a certain day. But other than that, in general, I would say, yes, Trump voters typically like the cops, most of them. But then you have sort of the more within the elite conservative world, there are those people, but then there's also this strain of, I think, very intellectually consistent libertarians who say, well, we don't like state power. We're pro small government. Well, I mean, you know, cops being able to just do whatever they want is obviously kind of, conflicts with small government and individual freedom. So they've pushed for more police accountability. And so I think some of it just comes from the fact that, look, there's libertarians kind of on the American right. And if you are an intellectually consistent libertarian, I mean, you don't necessarily want to abolish or defund the police, but you have good reason. You have sort of philosophical priors that will probably make you more kindly disposed towards certain left critiques of the police, and be more just inclined to believe that they are unaccountable and do bad things to people all the time. I think there is another dynamic, and I don't want to sort of impute motives to any particular person, but I'll just, in keeping with our theme of incentive structures, just point this out, that obviously a lot of conservatives, you know, get called racist, and a lot of conservatives don't like to be called racist. And one way to avoid being called racist is to say, but as a principled, intellectually consistent libertarian, I'm totally with Black Lives Matter on the police, you know, because I hate the police. It's big government. And then they end up, you know, not just sort of saying the police are bad in general, but often saying, and by the way, yeah, I mean, they're you know, the police are actually kind of racist. You know, it's not racism if the standardized test has a racially disparate impact. Of course not. But, you know, if the police using force has a racially disparate impact, oh, well, that, you know, that is racist because the police are bad. It's a bit of a caricature, but I do think some conservatives, and I've seen people, this is just like a fact. I'm not trying to say with any judgment, but I've seen people who work at like libertarian magazines and think tanks basically like and retweet or be liked and retweeted by folks who are clearly just very far left progressive lawyers who, you know, if they're not calling for abolishing the police, they're coming pretty close to it. And I mean, so there's kind of this like alliance that I suspect makes them feel like they're not, you know, not on the wrong side of history, and gives them some shelter from being beat up for being a bad person, you know, metaphorically beat up. But yeah, look, I've got to tell you, you know, just this is my own personal view, but I think there are valid criticisms of the police, but I really think that the cultural discourse, it's swung so far to one side that I think basically almost by default, anyone who's more pro-cop at this point is, you know, unless they're like truly just arguing for total impunity in every circumstance, I would say a good heuristic is that, you know, you should probably be more pro-cop because the culture is just so anti-cop that I think people who think police are basically good guys are, if not correct, then a lot closer to correct than the main rival.
All right, I know I've said this before, but I'll say it again. One of the reasons I'm in journalism is because I'm just relentlessly skeptical of absolutely everything, including those glowing MyPillow ads that we all see so much of. But my own skepticism personally was just gone immediately after trying MyPillow, which I really love. Did you know that MyPillow is also about more than just a fantastic pillow, though? Now MyPillow has given the same attention that they've given to those pillows I love so much to their new MyPillow Percal bed sheets. The sale of the year on those MyPillow Percal bed sheets is going on right now. The regular price for queen size sheets is $89.98, but now that's only $39.98 with your promo code. They're breathable, cool, and crisp. They're durable, built to last, machine washable for easy care, available in a variety of styles, colors, and sizes, and they also have a 60-day money-back guarantee. guarantee and a 1-year limited warranty. So go to MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429 for deep discounts on the MyPillow Percal bed sheets. Queen size regular for the price of $89.98 are now on sale for only $39.98. While there, you can take advantage of the buy one, get one sale on MyPillows, towels, and more. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429 today for the sale of the year on MyPillow Percal bed sheets. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. No, that's interesting. And I think you raised another really good point earlier. It's like, how much are appellate court rulings weighing on the minds of officers when they're in the situation where they have to make a split second decision to fire their weapon or not? And, you know, they don't even have time to think the whole word appellate in the moment that they have to make that decision. But, you know, obviously there's a cultural weight. And we want there to be, you know, of course, some stigma holding them accountable that needs to be there, because we know that they, you know, will use force inappropriately from time to time. And the thing that stops them from doing that are the laws and, you know, the social punishments that come with, you know, doing something bad. But now it seems the sort of balance is totally off. And it's not just because of the court decisions, although you can certainly understand how those would play a role. If you talk to police who have retired, if you talk to people who are trying to recruit police officers, it's really hard work right now. And, you know, go all the way back to Rodney King. Didn't someone record that on like an old school camcorder?
Yeah,
right. Right. And now everybody has those, basically in their pockets in a much smaller fashion at a moment's notice. And yeah, I mean, obviously there's good and bad, you know, there's good to having body camera footage, but there's also this question of how police are going to be treated even when they make the right decision. So in Minneapolis, just this week, or within the last week, there was a shooting in an apartment building. And Aaron, you probably heard about this. Shooting in an apartment building.
That's what I was referencing earlier.
Right. Yeah, sorry, I forgot about that. The shooting in the apartment building happens. The mom has, you can see the pictures, there's bullets fired into her apartment while she's making dinner for her children. There's a 6-hour standoff with police. The standoff ends with the man who had fired his gun being shot by police to end the deadly threat of an armed man shooting in an apartment building. And it's been a national controversy when, you know, best what it should be is a local investigation into whether that was a proper use of force that would, you know, almost surely, just because we have facts at this point, come out on the side of the officer. But instead, the woman is getting protested. She's getting shouted at. The mother who had bullets into her apartment is being told to shut up by protesters upset about the police officer's decision. This is a wild and dramatic swing in the other direction. And Aaron, just as we're wrapping up this conversation, the cultural incentives for officers to be paralyzed in moments when they need to act, that seems to me, you know, that the legal question plays into that. And so too do these conversations about, you know, everybody putting things viral with cell phone video. If you remember the case of the girl who was stabbing her friend and the cop shot her, she was about to stab her friend in a pretty dangerous way, and she was shot and killed by a police officer, and the left was upset about that. It just seems like the swing has been so dramatic that we're all less safe, and especially people in minority communities that rely on police being able to protect them, where violence is more common and frequent.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, obviously there were, you know, I'm not like pretending either that, you know, my piece was some platonic ideal of journalism totally immune from criticism, or that, you know, the facts as they came out kind of in the days following its release don't, you know, make you read certain parts of it differently. But I have to say, I was struck by just how vitriolic the reaction was even before, you know, this sort of new report came out questioning whether they really had a shot at the suspect. You know, people basically, you know, would see is on like two lines in it where they said, oh, well, there's more context you're leaving out. Then they'd proceed to, you know, explain the case in like its own sort of totally decontextualized way and leave out any facts that weren't, you know, congenial to their side. And that was like the best of it. The worst of it was just, you know, you are a fascist bootlicker. And like, look, I don't care. I mean, people can send me whatever they want. Like, I don't really, you know, I've gotten death threats in my DMs and I'm just like, oh, it's funny. Like, I don't care, but it's, but it's striking to me that it happens with this and not with other things. Like, I guess abortion, people, I'm sure emotions run high on that one. That's pretty, you can really get pilloried on social media for that. But like, you know, even a lot of the other stuff, I just don't think there's another topic where it arouses such strong bile.
And violent language and violent, yeah. Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, violent language and also just this like totally arrogant sense that, oh, obviously we know what happened in the case and obviously the officers made the wrong call and obviously they could have known better. I'm sorry, but most of the people saying that have never held guns in their lives or shot them. And even if they had, I mean, they're still being stupid and disingenuous. So, you know, I have to say, I think you're right that it's not just a legal thing. It's a cultural thing. And the media, frankly, plays a role in this, you know, as just sort of an aside. Yeah, like I find it very difficult to take anyone seriously who, you know, criticizes like my piece or any other piece for that matter in the Free Beacon, who then uncritically retweets Washington Post and New York Times article that will like make it sound like a cop, you know, like brutally shot some unarmed, you know, poor black man who was like surrendering and had like five children or whatever, you know, and then it turns out, oh no, he actually was like a knife wielding maniac who was trying to kill. So, I mean, it just, this happens. Yeah. Like I'm not, you know, obviously yes, there are bad shootings, but like some of the coverage, especially in 2020 and even recently, was just comically atrocious. And, you know, like, I will say just philosophically too, this is where I get like very conservative in the sense of order is good and the police are the agents of order. And ultimately, if you believe that, it doesn't mean that they don't have problems, doesn't mean they can't be reformed. But I would just argue anyone who believes in basic order should have a pretty strong presumption in favor of the cops in a lot of these cases, because the reality is that you can count on one, maybe two hands, the number of truly awful cases like George Floyd that happen a year. Maybe it's a little more than that. Like, I'd be willing to concede that there's probably at most like a few hundred just appalling instances of police misconduct that end either in life altering injury or death. But for every one of those, even if you assume it's like 100 or hell, even 1,000, which is probably more than it is, but like assume that for every one of those, there's like 100 more police, you know, police civilian encounters where the cops either do the right thing or, you know, do a very defensible, reasonable thing, given the fact that the person they're confronting is like committing a crime and, you know, you have to stop crime. And also as, you know, look, this is a kind of a liberal talking point, but we are a country that's awash in guns, and people can debate whether that's a good or bad thing. As long as it is the reality, cops who approach suspects have in the back of their mind, this guy could kill me. And mm-hmm. I think, frankly, like if you want to use that to argue for really strict gun control, that at least makes sense. Like, okay, yes, if we had fewer guns, the police could keep order without shooting as many people. I mean, that just seems analytically very hard to deny. But like, instead of saying that, you know, the narrative is just like, get rid of everyone's guns and also don't let the cops do anything because the cops are racist. So, I mean, it seems to me that the end goal here is, no one should have any guns, but like the bad people who do have guns, the cops shouldn't be able to stop because cops are racist. Well, like, you know, okay, but that you're effectively sentencing like hundreds of extra people every year in Chicago to horrible, violent deaths.
Like, yes.
All over the country. Yes. It's such a, I mean, at best misguided, at worst, just totally morally bankrupt position. I have very little patience for it. It's not one of the... No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and it's almost impossible to quantify. I mean, it's almost impossible for us to know what the exact cost of this like shift, both legally and culturally, is. And obviously, there has to be a balance, exactly as you're saying. But it's really hard for us to know what it is. And it's hard for us to say that's exactly what was happening in Uvalde. But the media also doesn't want to talk about the fact that, you know, it's likely that it did have some effect. Some effect. We don't know how much, but it's likely that this is affecting the way that police do their jobs.
Yeah. I mean, also, right, you know, oh, how dare you make a speculative psychological conjecture about what was going through the officer's heads. I mean, these are the same people who are telling us very confidently about how systemic racism affects the psyches of everybody. I mean, you know, how dare, I'm the one doing armchair psychology. I mean, give me a break.
Like, right. Or that Donald Trump needs to be 25th Amendmented.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, there's a similar, just my last comment is there's a similar dynamic at play in people who say they really support journalism. I mean, the vast majority of Americans want to be protected by the police. And if you want to be adequately protected by the police, you should approach the questions, you know, sort of fairly and, you know, willing to treat these topics with, you know, let them proceed through the justice system and let them proceed fairly. And similarly, the same people who say that journalists are the firefighters of our democracy, the second they see journalism that cuts against their narrative that they dislike, they attack the journalist for raising perfectly fine. You know, it's a much less dramatic dynamic, but it's the same thing. If you believe journalism is sort of crucial to our discourse and to the public, then, you know, journalism that's accurate, that's not being performed by the legacy media, is also important. And maybe you shouldn't dogpile the journalists doing it, because it creates an incentive for people not to question powerful media institutions.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you.
All right, Aaron, get back to the beach.
All right. Thank you.
Of course. Aaron Sabariam, he's a reporter at the Washington Free Beacon. He's the co-host of Institutionalized, which you should absolutely make sure to check out. You can read this story, the one we've been talking about on the episode, over at the Free Beacon. Aaron, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Emily.
You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.